Yeah, so my name is Karina Newsom, and my pronouns are she, her, hers.
If someone that you bump into says, what do? How do you answer that question?
I would say that I am a wildlife conservationist whose work centers around environmental justice.
And tell me a couple of the identities you hold. I already know a little about you and know that you are someone who holds several identities. And I wonder if there are a few that you want to make sure our listeners are aware of.
Yeah. So I am a Black woman. I am someone from a low-wealth community in a densely populated urban city, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, Germantown in particular. And I'm a scientist.
I think one of the identities that we are aware that you hold is that you also identify as a person of faith. We think this is so important for people of faith who are some of our listeners to be listening to scientists, to be listening to scientists. I wonder about how that identity as a person of faith has evolved for you.
So growing up, I was raised in a non-denominational Christian church faith background, and it was very much a center of my life and church itself, you know, physically being there and growing in community with my friends was like most of all of my social life. So church was very much the center of all that I did. It was also the structure with which I understood the world. And so I didn't come to, you know, kind of incorporate faith into my life at like a later age where I had kind of maybe built a perception of the world around me and then incorporated faith. Like faith was the entire structure. And that actually impacted quite a bit the way that the way that my faith was applied to what I learned going forward in life. And one of the main, I guess, conflicts that ended up arising was that because of the fact that I didn't know any scientists who are Christians, I didn't know anyone kind of outside of my very immediate faith community, I was taught essentially that there is this conflict or this inconsistency between, that was unreconcilable between faith and the study of science. And that essentially anything that I would learn as a scientist, whether it was how the earth and all the biodiversity on it came to be or the universe or, you know, issues around health, you know, healthcare and healing and health and so many things that I was taught were incompatible, I believed were incompatible. And then I went, I ended up going to Malone University, which is an evangelical Christian school in Canton, Ohio. And I had actually never heard of evangelical prior to going there. I didn't really know what that meant, but I was like, oh, it's a Christian school. And I actually didn't want to go to a Christian school because I was like, they're not going to teach me science. Like my understanding was that if it's a Christian, anybody telling me anything about science, they're going to like not prepare me for the world. They're going to teach things, you know, things that wouldn't be compatible with the field of science, like evolution or you know, any of the many topics. And so, but when I got there, I was like very, at first, unpleasantly surprised because I was challenged to actually think about my faith. It wasn't just like they were teaching me about science outside of my faith, like I was hoping they would do, right? It was like, oh no, there's a possibility that you can kind of like interrogate your faith around what you're learning. And I, at first it was terrifying. And I was like, I'm not saved anymore. I'm not a Christian. You know, and I was just like, I felt like my faith structures were crumbling around me. And I was so scared. I'll just say this. I remember one time when we had to take like Old and New Testament. And I took Old Testament first. And my Old Testament professor, on the first day of class, I'm like, he did me dirty. On the first day of class, he was like, okay, so when we go home, you know, your homework for the next class is to answer this question. He wrote it on the board and it said, who killed Goliath? And I was like, excuse me? And like, you know, now if someone presented a question that like may, you know, require me to rethink something that I already knew, that doesn't scare me anymore.
Right.
But as an 18-year-old, I was like, what do you mean by who killed Goliath?
Right.
Because if David didn't kill Goliath, then that means that it's possible that like everything I understand and the way that I understand and apply my faith could be totally different than what I've done my whole life. And I actually was scared. Like I was physically scared when I was thinking about this question. And that was the beginning. And like from that point on, like I was really taught to think about the like scripture as not just like a fantasy document about this other world, but like these are people writing about people. These are real life, you know, for the most part, like real life, just accounts of people's lives. And I was like, this is it. It just all. So I can talk forever about that. Essentially, over the course of my college career, I was taught to kind of rethink and look very closely at what I believed. And I emerged with this understanding and with a worldview that didn't have my faith in incompatibility with science and what I believe and what I see and what I study. And it was such a beautiful and freeing thing. And at that, you know, at that point, I realized, oh my gosh, it is, we do, the church is at such a disservice when we aren't connected with people who are in the sciences, who are
That's
also
right.
people of faith, who can help us think through the emerging challenges that we constantly have to face, whether it's, you know, a pandemic, whether it's climate change, whether it's, you know, natural disasters, war, like any of these things. Like we need to have these intersectional lenses when we're thinking about issues and problem solving. That is a really long answer. I would say now, the interesting thing, if it's okay, the interesting thing that has emerged for me now is that, and this is, I was just talking about this yesterday, so I'm fired up.
Great.
Is that over the past 3 years, approximately, when activism has been a real central part of my work around social justice. So I've worked in like climate activism. I've been a part of an organization called Young Evangelicals for Climate Action for several years, but it never was in the center of my life so much as it activism, generally speaking, is now, and where I'm really coming up against the tangible, like, hostility around inequity, right?
Yes.
From the general public. And so over the past 3 years, I've been really in the mix of that and talking a lot about environmental justice and a lot about the ways that racism and white supremacy manifests in every possible dimension of a non-white person, but in my case, a Black person's experience in the sciences, in recreation, in healthcare, and all these. And it just became, I was infuriated all the time, which it's not wrong to be angry, right? It's not wrong to get angry, but I was living in anger. I was like rooted in anger, and I was becoming unhealthy, physically unhealthy. I was becoming separated. I could feel it from my faith, from God. Like it was like an anger that was like made me not want, I was averse to like love. It was like, I don't want that right now. I don't need that. Like, it almost feels like that's not what the world needs. Like, we need to address these issues, and that requires. And so, like, and I'm like, how do you hold both of these? I never knew. I'm like, how do you hold the urgency and the need to like hold systems accountable and like shake them to pieces and destroy them and build new things? Right. How do you have that ability to do that? And also like walk in love. And when I say that, that doesn't mean lack of accountability or lack of anger or lack of any of that. But it's like, how do you not carry the burden of anger? Right.
Right.
Like, that's like a double whammy. Like you're kind of subjected to the injustice, and then you're carrying a burden of just the emotional response. And it was a lot, and it separated me from God. Literally within the past month, I have been rethinking everything. You know, I realized that the way that I came to think about my faith as a child, again, was from this, and I'm so sorry for how long this is taking. I'm almost done. The way that I come to think about my faith as a child, like, again, nothing was interrogated. It was just incorporated into what I, you know, how I believe the world to be in history and all these things. And I was like, I have to start over. I actually have to start over. Who was Jesus? Who is the great community organizer, as one of my pastors who I look up to, Reverend Dr. Heber Brown, says, a womanist community organizer, right? And I was like, let me start over, because I've been trying to reconcile, you know, how I came to have a faith as a child and how I came to believe with what I know to be true about injustice right now. And it's not matching up, and it's not working for me. So literally over the past month, I've been rereading the Gospels, like all of that, you know, from top to bottom, with a new perspective of who is Jesus, the person, right? You know what I mean? Like, and it's like changing everything. Like, I feel like a new person. I felt so out of touch with like the joy that I feel like God has naturally given me. And I feel like I'm becoming aware. I'm becoming back in touch and back in relationship with God, and like in touch with who it is he's called me to be. And it's just, there's not as much weight there, and I can move freely. There's freedom there. So all I have to say, Peter said, I'm so sorry for how much you're going to have to edit. That will be my answer, my long answer.
You know, faith journeys are not sound bites. They're not. So I appreciate the way in which that was long and circular and in process and in process. And you will be in my prayers. You will be in my prayers, because what you're wrestling with is huge. As you started talking about being, you know, the possibility of just being consumed by anger, actually an image of Jesus really came to my mind, of this person who was going through the world and being threatened and had very much had that possibility of being consumed by anger and at the same time wanted to challenge structures. So I will be thinking of you as you reread, and maybe I'll do some rereading with you in spirit. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank
so I wonder about... I wonder about the other angle of being a person of faith in a world of science. I also went to undergrad at a school in Ohio, and I was a math major. So not quite the science religion thing, but similar in that sense of being an active person of faith was quite countercultural and unusual. So I wonder the ways in which it sounds like your faith is very relevant for you personally as you engage, especially with environmental justice work. Is that conversation and identity welcome in the conversations that you're having with other scientists and activists?
You know what? It's so interesting that you ask that, because the hardest The place where that was the hardest to kind of interface with when it comes to faith and science was actually not in the quote unquote secular realm. It was in the faith environment where I have most of the pushback and most
interesting.
And once I got into this, outside of the kind of Christian education or academic structures and operating, in academia outside of faith and, in my jobs, like, That reconciliation has surprisingly not been challenging at all, like, which is really unexpected. Like, of course, there are people there have been individuals that I encounter who are like, who are actively and publicly hostile. But like, I think overwhelmingly people who are kind of at the front lines of, in particular, science communication. So scientists who have chosen to share their knowledge with the public, even professional, like people whose degrees are in science communication are realizing that like, we can't afford to like have this, like perpetuate this culture where scientists are on public platforms or anywhere like disparaging people of faith. Oh, you think there's a devil? What's wrong with you? Like, oh, you think, like just saying, like creating these active divisions and alienating people, because it actually, in this pandemic, we see what that does. So yes. You have kind of isolated entire populations of people from trusting scientists because you are constantly, for fun, for jokes, whatever, alienating them and making them feel inferior mentally because they are people of faith. And that has actual consequences in real life, even on you. You know what I mean? And so we're realizing how all-encompassing the way that scientists interact with the public and with the world actually is, and at how it interacts with people's identities. And like, I have never seen that before. I have never seen that kind of attention be taken to understanding how one feeds off of the other in my life. And so I think I'm coming into science. I would definitely still categorize myself as an early career professional.
Yeah.
In a different kind of culture around the where science meets people.
Yep.
Than I ever have before. And it has had major impact. So that's what I would say kind of about my experience there. And I have been invited by scientists who are not people of faith at all to share about my faith, because they realize that there's a need there. There's a need to have people people who aren't people of faith. How do you engage with faith communities as a scientist, right? There are these active efforts that are happening, and it's so encouraging. Yeah. And so that's really kind of been my experience, which
amazing.
I know is different from a lot of people.
I think it is different from an older generation of scientists. So I think that's really insightful and actually quite encouraging. Mm-hmm. I have been looking forward to having a conversation with you around the theme of paying attention. You are a contributor to a book that we have been engaging with a whole bunch at the BTS Center called Rooted and Rising, Voices of Courage in a Time of Climate Crisis, edited by Leah Shade and Margaret Bullet Jonas, both of whom are friends of this organization at this point. And you, in I think it's your opening paragraph, have this quote where you say, "I decided I would make a career out of my desire to look closely." And I highlighted that right away. I just love it. And I wonder if you want to just speak to that at all. I know that essay, in a way, is a few years old at this point. So, how you would talk about that concept right now.
Yeah, you know, I think that, and I, in a conversation I had recently on Instagram Live, one of the things that I realized coming from a low wealth background that has a lot of madness and chaos associated with it because of the low income, low resource context in which I lived, in which my family lives.
Yes.
One of the things that I realized is that when it comes to the busyness of staying afloat, it kind of eliminates our ability to kind of be in touch with our life source, which is the natural world around us, right? Which is another essentially layer of harm done to people living in poverty, people living in resource deprivation.
Yes.
And it creates just like this, a cycle that feeds on itself. It just depletes you, you know? And one of the things that I've realized recently, and like I've known, but it really kind of crystallized for me recently, was that, and depending on where you are, you have different amounts of access to this. I currently live in Atlanta, Georgia, which is called the city in the forest, because even in your most low income areas, we have like old growth forests and it just, it's unlike anything I've ever seen. That's not the case for every city and every, you know, low wealth community, by any means, especially in some of your biggest cities. But there are, even in those scenarios, there are ways to watch life, to look closely at the life that's happening. And there is an actual, like, you can feel the difference it makes in your body as far as the stress levels and just the constant, like, tension that just exists from not knowing and having to ration constantly. Like, that is such a taxing way to live.
Yeah.
And the moment you stop for 30 seconds and watch a living thing, something lifts inside of you. Something just like a burden just feels, it just, life feels lighter somehow. And so I've realized that looking closely is like very much a necessary opportunity that everyone needs to be able to do, but you don't necessarily know that it's there if you're not taught. So as much as I even love, I was already a wildlife nerd and I didn't even know that I could have looked closely at the world around me where I was and have seen so much life. I didn't know there was life to see. Of course, now that since I've gone back to Philadelphia and have like, and which is just very recent, even since that book chapter, and had the chance to just bird and look at birds, I'm like, oh wait, there are birds here.
Right.
I just didn't know because I had no teacher. I had no one showing me.
Right.
And I'm like, had I known to look at these things, I just imagine like how much stress I could have felt lift off of me in those moments where I was sitting panicked about like, oh my gosh, like I don't have lunch for tomorrow. What am I going to eat? Like, oh my gosh, like our electricity got cut off. Like, and I have to do all my homework before my battery runs out on my computer. Like all these moments where I had these just like gripping bouts of stress. And I could have looked outside and there was probably something I could have stared at that would have lifted a burden even a little bit. And so it's, you know, kind of going back to the origin, not only is that like a stress reliever that I'm really tapping into now and encouraging people to engage in now, but it's like, it's fun. Like, oh my gosh, especially if you're a person of faith, it's like, wow, you are able to see a reflection of the creator who spoke this into existence, like, and watch his word continue to create life, right? Like we're continuing to see how life is bursting at the seams from everything from like the diversity of birds on the planet all the way down to like the morphology of a caterpillar. It's just like there's so, and you can never see it all. So it's just like a constant bottomless like jar of gold. Like you can just like, and you, so if you, there is no end to the supply of wonder. There's no end to the supply of healing that looking closely outside provides you. And I'm just so grateful to our creator for giving us that bounty. And I'm very committed to addressing the ways in which that bounty is not accessible equally.
Yes.
So that's a kind of part of the work that I try to do.
I wonder about the possibility of faith communities and faith leaders really playing a role in helping people of many, many backgrounds access both that healing and energizing places in the natural world, in the more than human world. I have started a naturalist training program here in Maine. And a week ago, we were doing winter botany. And so we were looking at twigs. And, you know, twigs are usually, you know, long and thin. And their vascular system, is, you would imagine, would be circular. And for many trees, if you look at the end of a twig, it'll be a circular system. In some trees, the shape of that thing is a triangle or a star or a square. And I mean, you know, so I spent 15 years living in Philadelphia also, and now, you know, and now have spent a couple years in Maine. And yes, nature is a little more accessible here, but finding a twig was possible in Philadelphia. And so, you know, my mind has just shifted in all these ways that, yes, wilderness has these connotations of grand landscapes, you know, getting to the top of a mountain and seeing a space that is less defined by humans. But if you think about the shape of, it's called the pith, the shape of the pith in a twig, and that also being a way of accessing wildness and freedom and mystery and the divine. I think the BTS Center is really interested in helping faith leaders and faith communities honor that and point to that and help people direct their gaze in that way. It is about equity, right? It's about equity. I wonder if there's anything that story has brought up for you as we think about where we pay to what we pay attention and for how long we hold our gaze.
Yeah, that's a really beautiful way to put that. And I would say that one of the a really incredible example of a framework through which I've seen faith communities, and specifically Black faith communities, engage with this, and it's not even so much in the realm of, or from the perspective of exploration for exploration's sake, or but in the context of actually addressing resource inequity and resource depletion, and from the framework of food sovereignty. And so I've seen churches. There's a faith community that has created the Black Church food. Oh gosh. I have to look this up. I'm sorry. I can't even think of it right now, but it's like a Black church food sovereignty network that essentially connects churches together across kind of the East Coast. And they, part of their ministry is being outside and learning about food systems and like having people grow food and having people share food. And they're, you know, like that in itself. So, right. Yes. Like thinking about, in addition to the just the joy of, wow, like look at these pits, like look at these, look at this biodiversity. It's like, look at how food grows and like, look at how much bounty there is when we do it ourselves. And, you know, like there are so many benefits that come from that, that addresses the issues in equity, but also connects people to our source of life.
Yeah.
And then of course with that is this growing wonder, and you are then positioned to look closely. Oh my gosh, like look at what just came up out of the earth when I pulled up this carrot. Look what just came out, you know, like look at the wildlife that's using this space that we have cultivated for our food and using it for their own resources too, you know? And it's like they're seeing it be addressed in that kind of an intersectional way is such a beautiful, beautiful thing. And it's tied very closely to activism. It's tied closely to community organizing. But it creates the space and the framework for people to be able to be connected, especially those, you know, communities who have been deprived of resources, to be connected to the source of life, of joy, of wonder. And so I try to find ways to model that where I try to prop up those kinds of examples. Like, look at how multidimensional the benefits are when we do this.
So my work in Philadelphia was around doing interfaith understanding work in neighborhoods and schools and congregations. And the way in which having diverse worldviews and perspectives at the table when we came across a challenge was so important. And it's sort of this ecosystem way of operating that diversity builds the possibility for resilience. And I have been so moved to learn about the ways in which you have been really passionately working to increase diversity in conservation and animal sciences and outdoor recreation and so much more. This feels incredibly important to me. And so I kind of want to just give you a moment to like preach it, you know, and give this message to the audience that's listening to this podcast, how important that diversity is in these fields where it has not existed.
Yeah. Thank you for creating space for that and for bringing that up. And I think one of the assumptions that needs to be addressed first in the, you know, the context of these conversations, whenever I'm kind of bringing this up to an audience of any kind or an individual, especially those who are kind of in decision-making power, it's that our intentions, you know, our good intentions are not enough. Like, it's not enough to care about communities who have been forced into the margins and deprived of resources and deprived of their connections and their culture, right? It's not enough to care deeply, like, and sincerely about it. It just is the reality that you do not possess the perspective that is able to flag the ways that the decisions you're making as an institution, as a governing body, whatever it might be, are going to impact them. You simply can't know it because you're not them. And so for that reason, it's important to not only just have diversity at the table or a diversity of perspectives, but that you are shifting the power dynamic from you having the last word on everything to the people, not only having them there, but having them make the decisions about how, you know, in my field, how their land is managed. And there are so many ways in which the vocabulary I'm using is a reflection of, like,
that's right,
colonized conservation. Right. But, like, you know, and so, like, people, you know, either it's like, oh, we care very much about, and so that's enough. Or, oh, we have these people, we have an advisory group, or, you know, these meetings that we hold with community stakeholder meetings. They love that. We have these stakeholder meetings, right, where we're bringing all of these diverse perspectives to the table. But ultimately, you hold all the power, and you are, that's the part that is the hardest for people to let go of, is you can't just have the diversity present. You just can't have the brown faces in the room, the poor folks in the room. Like, you have to give the people the power. And essentially, as it pertains to, like, ecosystems and thinking about biodiversity, we understand that in conservation and, in, you know, the management of endangered species and vulnerable populations, things like that, we understand that, like, literally the having, you know, genetically speaking, or thinking about a larger ecosystem, having the diversity there to be able to have the power to, quote unquote, make decisions about the next generation, okay, is so important for that community's survival, right? Like, when you think about, and I say this a lot, but when you think about a population of individuals, if there is a bunch of sameness, as much as they want to survive, their desire to survive is not enough. If everyone is the same, they're all susceptible to the very same stressors. That's the main, you know, but if their genes are diverse and you have a lot of genetic diversity within a population of a species, when a particularly terrible stressor or issue comes along, somebody's genes are likely to the answer to that problem. And then that gets passed down, and their generation, their offspring, are able to survive. And so it's, you know, we understand how literally foundational diversity and having that diversity being able to inform essentially the next steps is. We have to apply that same value system to how we make decisions and how we people wield power. Like, we don't want power. We cannot afford to have power concentrated anymore. Power concentrated in these singular, homogenous rooms and spaces. Yep. And so, I always encourage, you know, people who work in these fields to understand, like, how multidimensional the need for diversity and diverse, decision makers actually is.
Right. Right. And what you were saying made me think both of, like, agriculture and the way that we have gone to monoculture crops and the way in which we now are experiencing the threat of you know, whatever is coming their way, there's not that diversity anymore to respond with flexibility. Yes! And I think that's so, it's just so true for human populations. That's also.
So I'm like trying to find a pen. I'm like, respond with flexibility is so critical. And it really intersects with like the climate crisis and all of them, but the climate crisis in particular, because what we're realizing is that like adaptation is how we survive. Yes. You cannot adapt if everyone is the same. Like, it is literally impossible. And you know this. We know this at a biological, at the most granular level. It is impossible to adapt.
Yep.
Everyone is the same. And so, like, if you want to survive, you know, the people who have been in power the whole time, like, you're not going to make it out of this. You think that having the power is going to get you out of this or protect you. It's ultimately not going to protect you. You're going to go with the whole group if you choose to be the only people who can make decisions and hold that power. And so, like, that is so, I need to write this down after we get off this call, because like that is so, yes, adaptation, flexibility. Oh my gosh. Yes.
Well, I do think about times when we faced a challenge in Philadelphia and had worked so hard to create a table where there was not one decision maker and people of many different faith traditions had equal voice. And there were times that someone in that group had more experience in responding to the sort of thing mm-hmm. that we were facing, or it touched them in a much more personal way and they had better insights into what should be mm-hmm. done. And that allowed the group to pivot and focus in a way that it never could have if those voices weren't there to say, actually, I think I got the lead on this one. Yeah. And I think that that is so important as we respond to climate change. We have been doing a lot of work within the theme of imagination and the ability to see things as possibly being otherwise. And we think this is a huge role for faith communities and faith leaders. Like this is the wheelhouse of alternative narratives and vision and prayer and coming up with imagination. But diverse perspectives, diverse backgrounds are, I think, essential to those imaginative capacities and the ability to see things as otherwise.
Oh my God. And I have to say that Peterson Toscano was like the first person that really introduced this idea to me of like imagination and how critical that is. And I remember one time in like a conversation several years ago at this point where he was talking about, you know, he was speaking with somebody and they were talking about, I think it was probably in a previous podcast episode that he had hosted where they were like, you know, what in the future that we want, what does it smell like? And I was like, what does it sound like? And I was like, oh, I've never even imagined what those, like, I have not even pictured the solution, right?
What it's does
like,
it
I
taste
know what
like?
The problem is. Yeah, like, it's like, I know what the problem is. I know that we want it to not be that.
Yes.
But like, what is, could in its fullness, it be? What would it be? You know, and it's like, I realize that takes like real time and real thought and like can be very hard to access that imagination when you are stripped of the freedom to like, live in the fullness of your humanity, which a lot of socioeconomic marginalization and all that injustice does to you. It strips you of that. And many, it can strip a person of that. It stripped me of that. And so like imagination, I realized, and I after our conversation, I was on a bird walk, like a night hike one time. And I sat there. It just landed on me what Peterson had told me. And we were on a campfire roasting marshmallows. I said, y'all, I have to tell you what I learned. How important imagination is. And I had everybody just, wow. I said, listen, man, like I'm learning. The things I'm learning are changing my life. Peterson, I can't thank you enough. But yes.
But I think it for me, it's related to this looking closely, you know, spending time observing the amazing things about a bird population or the pith in a twig. It unleashes a certain form of imagination that I think is desperately needed right now. And for me, this really relates to the question of hope, which I think people of faith kind of get this question thrown at them. Okay, you're a person of faith, so where's your hope? You know, like, I need hope. Yeah. Can you give me some hope? I don't know if you've had that experience or not, but yes. When I opened up your essay in Rooted and Rising, another time, I loved that you started with this reference to Emily Dickinson, who says, "Hope is the thing with feathers that perches in the soul."
Yeah.
So I'd love to hear your thoughts on hope and what moved you so much about that quote to, you know, have it be the what brings people into that essay.
Yeah. So I think for me, the reason why that essay or that poem was so meaningful to me was that as I began to learn about birds and study them very specifically and very closely, I realized, and I referenced a scripture in that essay about where God is, right? Mm. If I go to I might misquote this, Lord have mercy. But essentially, no matter where I go, you are there. If it's the depths of hell, you're there. Mm-hmm. If it's, you know, on the mountaintop, you're there. And it reminded me of birds so much because there's nowhere just about that you can go where there aren't birds.
Amen.
You can be in the, you know, filthiest, like most urban, like polluted environment.
Yeah.
And you're going to see these extremely like hardy house sparrows. They may not be, they may be an invasive species, but they're still in their own right, inherently beautiful birds, incredible species, right? You see life finding a way to exist and even thrive in many ways. And then, of course, if you go to these very, what many people would consider to be pristine kind of ecosystems, of course, you see a brilliant diversity of birds. You also see in places where birds are kind of given the resources they need to thrive, you see a greater diversity. You see, you know, so there's this pairing of understanding that with kind of releasing the bondage of injustice that creates resource scarcity and creates an overall scarcity in the lives of people like me and my family who have kind of been in the middle of situations like this. Like when people are free to live in the fullness of their creativity, they're like that imagination and that hope, it just comes alive. It just bursts. And I've realized recently as I've been working more with young people and in particular young people who are from backgrounds like mine,
you know,
communities of color, Black communities, low wealth communities, right? Like seeing them kind of, and it has to, you know, there are a lot of threads here, right? Like whether it's like our identity that we've kind of felt the need to, or felt, you know, hostility towards because, you know, because of white supremacy and because of, you know, anti-Blackness and things like that. There's seeing just the cultivation of love of self and all of who you are has created a situation in which people are able to be so much more creative and be so much more imaginative. And that has really been the thing in which my hope has dwelled, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, wow, like we actually, there's a whole lot more capacity here than I ever thought was possible because people are able to exist in their fullness, in the fullness of their humanity. And when people experience marginalizations of who they are, whether it's because of their sexual orientation or because of their socioeconomic status or because of their ethnic identity, like that cramps us. Like we're not even able to, we are not able to contribute. Like it's just we can contribute so much more when we are able to exist in the fullness of our humanity. And so the reason why that poem to me was so important is because a single bird, right? A single bird in my act of studying them closely. If you were to look at it, you'd be like, oh, this thing is fragile. Like if you pick up a bird, right? You're like, this thing is lightweight. I could literally crush it if I try not very hard in my hand, right? It's full of hollow bones. It's full of air sacs, right? Like it's mostly feathers. It feels like nothing. Like it would just crumble under the pressure, right? And I feel like that is an assumption that a lot of people make about people who are pushing the margins of society,
amen.
who are like in these vulnerable positions. It's like one thing goes wrong and it could tear you apart. Like, you know what I mean? It just, even from being someone in that position, it feels vulnerable, right? But at the same time, so say like a little ruby-throated hummingbird that you can't even feel it if you're holding it. It's like, am I holding anything? This same bird is flying over the Gulf of Mexico. And it takes a lot more work for this bird to fly than any other bird. So hummingbirds aren't like hawks that can just like have their wings out and soar, right? Or a vulture. Like it's constant movement. It is constant work. constant powered flight the whole time. They're flying over open ocean, open water, nonstop, 18, 22 hours without ever stopping, all the way down to South America, right? And it's like, if I was just to say to somebody, what do you think this can do?
Yes.
If I presented them a hummingbird, what do you think this can accomplish? They would never say what they actually can do. They would never imagine that they could, right? And so the combination of birds existing in every place you can imagine, the combination of that with, you know, the fact that birds don't seem like they should be able to do very much, but they do just about the hardest physical feats of any living thing on this planet with their incredible migrations and their breeding seasons and the way that they live and survive. It's just like, you would never think. And to me, that reminds me of the plight of my people. That reminds me of like the way that people interpret us, right? And our capability and our capacity. And it's like, oh no, like you might think that we are fragile. You might think that we, you know what I mean? But look how much we actually, you know what I mean? Like it's so, yes, there are so many layers to why birds embody hope for me. And studying them has really crystallized and helped me to see, wow, like the things that seem absolutely impossible are very much possible and are happening in magnitudes and on scales that we can't even picture.
So amazing. I mean, you diving into, we must challenge assumptions of fragility, both in the human and the non-human world. I just want to say amen to that. That's such an important message for us, but it requires health and wholeness of the systems for that to be unleashed. And we must work on that. So I wonder about taking this in one other place, which is actually around grief and lament. And the BTS Center has been spending some time thinking about what ecological grief and lament might look like and mean for faith communities and faith leaders to model for a broader society. Care around times of death is something that religious communities do. And we are facing incredible loss right now. We talk about a climate-changed world, that this is not 100 years away. It's not 10 years away. The reality of climate change is here. And grief is a powerful reflection of love. You know, you grieve something if you love it. And I think part of our hope is, how might we inspire the kind of love that leads to grief? And for those who are experiencing grief and do not have a place for that to be held in community, do not have a place for that to be expressed, might actually creating that space lead to more love? Like, is that possible?
That is so... Nicole, that is so good, because real quick, so Don't Look Up, the movie, right? There are mixed reviews. Some people hated it. Some people loved it. I watched it recently, a few weeks ago. And I remember at the end of the movie, so during the movie, there are these, not to give anything away, there are just these flashes of just life in other places outside of where the main plot is happening, right? There's hippos doing something you know, on the side of a body of water. There's an ant, you know, drinking water or something like that. There were just these flashes of things happening other places, right? So I watched the full movie, and I remember for the first time, I actually felt grief about the biodiversity and climate crisis. I had felt angry. I had been full of anger. I had been enraged, right? But the emotion was never grief before, really, at all. And all, because in that movie, of course, it's a very sudden, you know, like they're dealing with like, in one instant, everything is going to be gone if we don't do something, right? Like, so they're dealing with that kind of a situation. And I wept for hours after that movie. Like, literal hours. I had to, like, isolate myself. I was with my friend. I was like, y'all have to leave me alone tonight. Like, I was weeping. And I was like, wow. Like, and I realized that there had maybe been some pent up, you know, stuff there. And I realized that they're like, what, as you were describing kind of this relationship between grief and love, right? I think a lot of people try to move others to action from the place of grief, right? From the place of frustration or anger or, you know, as opposed to move them from the place of love, which yields to grief when there's loss, right? Like you said. And so the other element that is very saddening is when you are in grief alone, as you said just now, like when you don't have community, that is a hopeless kind of grief.
Well, and you even named that you took that in and needed to isolate. There's such a pressure to deal with your sadness on your own.
Yes.
And what would it look like for actually us to hold one another in community in that grief?
Oh my, yes. You know, and the reason why I isolated myself is because I was like, I was a non-biologist. I was like with musicians and I was like, they don't understand why I'm crying. And I just look like.
It's totally what people do. It's totally what people do. Yes.
So I went to another room and just stayed there all night and wept. And like you said, like that creates a grief that is like almost like infused with hopelessness. And that is one of the worst places to be. Mm. But like, what if we had grief that was like filled with hope, that was like then energized by hope? You know what I mean? Like we mourning because we love it. We loved it. Right. But like we are now prompted to like, you know what I mean? Like we are energized to continue the work. It's an energizing, you know, community engaging moment. Like, you know, and it's grief still hurts and it never shouldn't hurt. Right. But it's just, it can take us in polar opposite directions. Isolation, stagnation, you know, activation and hope. It's like, which way can we go?
Right.
And it is so important to find people with whom we can sit in that with and like problem solve with and imagine with, right? Because like imagination is really so much part of our ability to hope and think of what a beautiful future could look like, as we've been saying. And so I always encourage people to find like-minded people. And sometimes it's not, you know, it may not be in your faith community that you have right now. Your church may not be the place for it. Like it may be your local, you know, community organization that's working to address environmental issues and may not have a faith component at all. But like find people. And when you have the capacity, like that builds your capacity to engage audiences that may not have thought about this, right? Because if you're isolated, grieving, and then try to move congregations or groups of people to action, it's like, burnout, burning the candles at it's not sustainable and it's not healthy either. And so being able to have a community that re-energizes you and encourages you and is able to give you energy around this work is so critical. And yes, sometimes we are the only person in a space that's really talking about something, but I have repeatedly, and this is part of my hope, I've seen people respond affirmatively like, oh yes, like, okay, from now on, you know, from now on, every spring, we're going to have church outside. I don't know nothing about wild, you know, it'd be my friends who are pastors, you know, I don't know anything about wildlife or about these birds or whatever, but will you come and talk about the birds to the church? Or like, I don't know anything about like the climate change science, but will you come, you know, and it's like, there are people who are ready. There are people who are ready to hear it. And it's so beautiful when you encounter those people. And so, I need to sit down and journal about you.
I'm going to be journaling after this conversation too, Karina. Yeah. I've appreciated it so much. I wonder if there's anything else that you might want to add just in terms of who you are and the context from which you're speaking. Anything that I mean, in some ways this might get put towards the top, but now that you've had this conversation, is there anything else you want to help our listeners, you know about who you are?
Okay, so if I had to start over, if you said, who am I? Who are you? Like you did at the beginning, I would say that I am... So I'm a wildlife conservationist whose work is centered around environmental justice for people, for communities of human beings. I'm in a state where my faith in Christ is part of my hope, but in many ways has been deconstructed and is being reformed. And it's helping me to understand the complexity as well as the capacity for manifesting the vision that we want to see for our communities in ways that I really, up until recently, didn't even have the capacity to imagine and have the capacity to think about. I am really brimming. I am overwhelmed with gratitude. I'm overwhelmed with hope for the people that I've been able to build relationship with. the only thing that has drawn me out of hopelessness, the only thing that has drawn me out, I should say things that have drawn me out of what has at times felt like bottomless rage and anger around the issues that we're facing, is being able to be in relationship with people and relationship with creation, of which we are, of course, a part. And I think that separation from creation is what has led to the entirety in many ways.
Yes.
Of the injustice, of the exploitation, of the scarcity that we now have and that we're subjected to. Lack of relationship with creation and creator has created this situation. I'm encouraged to meet people and to engage with people who see the interconnectedness of these elements and who thrive and root their work in relationship. And I think that that is one of the huge keys to our success as a unit, as a human community, as we move forward in realizing justice for the creation that God has spoken into existence. And I'm excited about the work and I'm grateful. Thank you. I don't know. That was a lot.
You know what? I'm glad I asked that question, because actually now I could restart a whole hour conversation. I'm like, ooh, let's go there too. Interconnectedness and separation and the way it's led to. So that was really, that was great. That was great to add those pieces in. I so appreciate it. It's lovely to know you. And I'm so grateful to Peterson for bringing us together.
Yes. I thank you for taking the time to even talk to me. And Peterson, I am always amazed that you, like, even when you make these connections, like to connect me with the incredible network of people that you have, that you're in relationship with. And I'm just like, man, you've put a lot of trust in me. But I'm so grateful.